Devin. Coming up next on More Talk Radio, Georgetown sociology professor and author Michael Eric Dyson visits KABU to talk to Cecil and Celeste about his new book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. That's coming up in just about 3 minutes. At 9 o'clock on the Olmo Variety Hour, they will have interviews with Matt Dos Santos, legal director of the ACLU of Oregon, Erica Edelson of California's local Clean Energy Alliance about resistance to Trump's policies, and Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey of Columbia Riverkeeper talks about the world's largest methanol refinery that's coming to the Northwest. At 10, Chris Andre and Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet. And at 11, On the Ground Radio presents voices from the mass protest in Washington, D.C. of the inauguration, plus author and activist Professor Gerald Horn breaks down Trump's first week in office. All of this great programming on KBOO because of the generosity of KBOO members just like you. And if you'd like to get on the team, please do so by going to KBOO.fm and clicking on donate. It's 8 o'clock.
This is Love Jones, producer of the world famous confessional. This year, Contessa de la Luna brings you a real bona fide Wild West jamboree and variety show. We've got live performances by Contessa de la Luna and Courtney Vondrell from Three Leg Torso, plus audience lasso contests, sock puppet theater, surprise fun box drawing, many other prizes. We've got performances by the Sea Charms and a selfie booth with Contessa de la Luna. We've got plenty of surprises and fun in store, so mark your calendars Thursday, February 9th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds benefit KBOO, your community radio station. Tickets are available now online at contessawestern.brownpapertickets.com or at the door the night of the event. Get your hat, get your spurs, and come on down Thursday, February 9th at the Clinton Street Theater starting at 7 p.m. Contessa de la Luna's Wild West Jamboree, an old-time variety show.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Hello, KABU members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KABU Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KABU Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KABU board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There's a time commitment about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KABU member. To apply, go to KABU.fm or stop by the station and pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is February 18th at 5 p.m. We are looking for folks who love KABU, who are committed to the community and KABU's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. Apply today to support your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
You are listening to your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in all points east along the Columbia River Gorge. In the Willamette River Valley, it is 104.3 and everywhere. You can get KABU at KBOO.fm. I want to welcome all my listeners, especially my members, and those who are just now discovering our station here to More Talk Radio. And I have a plum of an interview. And it's going to be a plum that is delicious, but also it has a stone. And I'm going to take that stone metaphor just a little bit further and say the purpose of this one is to take that plum and sear that stony heart right out of it. What are you talking about, Celeste? Well, it's simply this. We live in a country that most of the world has been taught to idolize, to see as a beacon, to see as a place of promise. But it is not always that. And one of the reasons it's not always that is because it was founded upon on a lie. It was founded upon the lie that all men are created equal, but some people have to work for everybody else to be equal. And those people work hard for no money, for no citizenship, for no right to vote, all of those things. A dream was not meant for them. Theirs was the reality, the harsh reality of work and of being disengaged and disenfranchised. And that America is the America, the United States of America, in which we are now really having a lot of fears and outcrops of racism, some virulent racism, something that is not new, something that some people can't see, but something that a lot of people feel and feel that that has been unaddressed. So I have with me today a man, a mind, a voice. And that man with his mind and his voice possesses a passion that hopefully will sear that stony heart right out of the racist parts of this country. And to help those folks who don't have a racist heart, have a heart for people, have a heart for unity, to know what they're supposed to do now, what they can do. I have with me here with no further fanfare, Michael Eric Dyson. Did I give you too much fanfare?
Lord have mercy. Lord, I'm taking you on the road with me.
Well, I get teased a lot because, you know, I can dress it up. But what I like here is that you've undressed something. And we're going to talk about this book that you have written. And it came out last Tuesday, I believe you said, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Mm-hmm. It couldn't be more timely. And I can imagine that you probably did not intend to write this book when you did, but all of a sudden that spirit came upon you and said, oh, I can't be still.
Can't be still. Because I had, you know, had enough of looking at black men and women cut down, mowed down on the streets of America by police people executing their duties while executing black people. And so I wrote an op-ed around the time of Sterling and Castillo's death last summer. And that engendered such a huge response. Over 2,500 people responded to that essay, to that op-ed on the New York Times website that, you know, I knew it was time for me to expand the argument, dig deeper into my own reflections on what was going on and offer from my heart and from my mind my perceptions of and perspectives on race in America.
So it's not as though you haven't written on these before, and it's not as though you have not had your own personal experiences before that have
That's
been
right.
searing.
That's right.
But what was it about these two particular deaths that just pushed it over the edge?
It was the fact that here we were looking yet again at another videotaped execution. These are essentially snuff films of black men in this case, but black people more broadly, who are enduring execution at the hands of the state, that their murders are being offered on film as visual evidence of the moral carnage that is in the offing when these police officers are not held to account and act with dispatch as judge and juror on the streets of America, executing black men with no good reason. That was enough to push me over the edge.
Now, that's pretty loaded in with so many different issues. I mean, just to echo that whole idea of carnage with what our new president Trump said, American carnage. I don't think he really understands what the American carnage is.
Yeah,
but then the whole idea that we have a record of what's been going on for hundreds of years, mm-hmm. that now everybody can see, and it's indisputable.
Right.
The fact that you are saying this is a socially and a state sanctioned killing,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that with our law enforcement officers under siege right now,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are a lot of people that say, well, wait a minute, hold on. That sounds like you are accusing all police and all law enforcement efforts as you're accusing them as being, a bunch of unchecked murderers.
Mm.
And so I want to take each one of those three,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of unpack them a little bit, but also to weave in the narrative of your book, which is a sermon.
Right. Exactly. Well, to give me the three elements and I'll hit them
okay.
right away.
That moral / American carnage. That's something that's unique to us.
Yes. Well, and that moral / that moral carnage, that social distress, to which I make reference, has been generated out of a society that refuses to acknowledge the humanity of black people. Black Lives Matter arises at a moment, ironically enough, under a black president, where black activists have to remind America that our lives matter also, that we are worthy of protection and consideration, that we are worthy of police people treating us with equality and justice, treating us with dignity and grace as they do any other citizen in American society. And so the carnage occurs when there is a failure on the part of these police to acknowledge the fundamental humanity of black and brown people. In regard to seeing them as an executioner or as executioners, I don't hold that all police are executioners, but I hold that a culture of policing in America has tyrannized and terrorized black people, and that on any given day, a number of police people may indeed execute the vision and the understanding that some cops have of their role and responsibility in America. And some of that, a large degree of that, has to do with how black people and brown people are treated, and it is not a good thing.
And so when we look at it in terms of how it's played out through the various systems we have, you know, economic, educational, judicial, et cetera. Okay, and we're looking at, and we're focusing right now, just for this split second here, on law enforcement. We're talking about, again, not people, but a system that corrupts people.
Mm-hmm.
So let me peel something off so we can shut this down really quick. One of the things that I say about the system is we have to acknowledge that our judicial system works. It works mm-hmm. because it keeps the poor and the minorities in check, and it perpetuates and perpetrates laws and policies to keep the 1%, 1%.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. So what we have is a bad policing system, and that bad policing system not only kills people, but it ruins good cops.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of something that you have said in your book about people need to stand up and do something, what should our good cops be doing caught up in this bad system?
Yeah, it's a great point. If it's a systemic problem, if it's system-wide, if it's the deadening effect of being ensnared in a broader and deeper system that overrules and overrides one's own individual agency, or at least shapes it in such a decisive fashion, it is difficult to simply point to a particular or individual cop as opposed to the culture of policing in America. That being said, since all police people are not, you know, behaving the same way, they are not automatons, they are not mechanical figures, but rather they are pushed and pulled by forces, psychological and social, and racial, then we can both acknowledge the broader impact of the larger society in shaping our perception about what police people do, and then we can hold them individually to account for the ways in which they choose to behave while on the job and their treatment of black and brown people, their perception of them, their ignorance or knowledge about them as well.
So in other words, what a good officer can do is speak out and not allow themselves to be shaped, pulled, distressed into this particular mindset.
Well,
if you come into this system and you recognize that this is not working for you, you have either the option of leaving or standing up and talking and recognizing that sometimes doing the right thing, standing on the moral high ground, means it makes you a better target.
No doubt. But there are some implicit bias. Mm-hmm. I don't claim that they all are conscious of or understand.
No, they're not.
But
mm-hmm.
the system itself gives license
yes.
to and supplies logic for the behavior and gestures that they adopt. And as a result of that, they are often acting at the behest of, often unconscious imperatives or,
or
racial profiling that they are not aware of.
Sometimes very conscious efforts by bad cops
to
threaten them. So we want to say that's part, but I want to look at that now as part of the other one of the three, and that is the social sanction attitude that either there is no racism anymore, or there is no bias anymore, or what I have heard said by people. Well, you call it a system. You say racism or institutional racism is a system. I can't see a system. How can I fight it? What are you talking about? If I can't see it, it's not real. So that is one of the things I think that keeps people from also checking with the law enforcement. So how do we deal with that? Because you call people out.
Right. Well, there is a manifestation of a system, though.
Yes.
The barriers are there. The outlines are there. The barbed wire is there. Invisible hindrances and impediments, and some are visible. There are boundaries that are offended, and we know them when we cross them, even if we don't know beforehand that they are there. So a systemic, function of prejudice and racism and implicit bias certainly operates. It gets called out. People begin to acknowledge it. We begin to inform others that, when you are racially stereotyping and profiling black men in the streets of New York and that is turned down, you can't continue to do so. And as President Trump tried to suggest that stop and frisk would work and therefore something that should go on, though it was rude, unconstitutional, or at least illegal. But we see the bleeding. We see the broken windows that are the barriers that mark, the limits of that state. And every now and again, we are introduced to its barbarous limits and its heinous, parameters. So it's not like we don't ever feel the system. We don't feel it in its totality, but we feel its force. We feel its power and its energy. We feel its nullifications. We feel its, aberrations, and we feel its mistakes and its tragedies and trauma. So
okay.
All of that stuff is operating, and we certainly cannot claim not to have any empirical evidence about the function of that system.
Well, we as folks of color most definitely could never say that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when you look at the idea of whiteness and white America, mm-hmm. it's really easy for people to say, well, I don't see that. And then it becomes a function of personality or quote unquote lack of breeding or, bad manners or a deviant or criminal personality, whatever. And so it's really easy for people to kind of blow it off and say, well, yeah, but, if you were acting good, that wouldn't happen.
Right. Well, the reality is that a lot of white folk don't act good.
Yeah, that's
right. Don't behave well. And they don't get mistreated. So the point is that there's a targeting, there's a specificity and particularity, a discomfort one, a disconcerting one, an uncomfortable one that has to be marked. And
that
it gets
whole devaluing of black folks.
Devaluing of black life,
mm-hmm.
humiliation of black life, demonizing of them. And it can also be manifest in terms of an empirical verification of that inclination by looking at the disparate practices and the numbers that suggest that black people are singled out, brown people are singled out and treated in an unjust fashion.
Okay, so then that brings us back to the top issue then, which is this moral carnage. You have said that people cannot say they're down with mm-hmm. the cause without doing something. And to borrow on the fact that this is written as a sermon, and to piggyback on the fact that I'm speaking to an ordained minister here, faith without works is dead.
Right,
faith
right,
without
right.
works is dead.
Right,
so,
right.
So people who care or who want to learn how to care, how can they see? What do they need to do? How should they stand up and be counted?
Well, you know, people who care should speak up. If you see something, say something. That's what mm-hmm. they tell us about
yeah.
in terms of, you know, the broader society vis-a-vis terror. So if you see something going on that is problematic, white brothers and sisters, make a contribution. Talk, speak up, acknowledge it, say it's wrong. When people come at us, you know, with the arguments and to deal with one of those three pillars you talked about, where, excuse me, not only the moral carnage, but the ways in which, you know, we're trying to blame an entire police force. No, we're trying to say, but a culture of disregard and humiliation does pervade a police force. We can't just blame individual white brothers and sisters who happen to be cops. We have to also talk about a culture that produces the logic of their behavior that justifies what they do and exempts them from some of the moral critiques and the intellectual and especially the political reprimands that might be delivered to them. Beyond that, one that joins both the moral carnage argument with, you know, the police culture argument is the fact that, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, most black people who are killed by black people. Police don't do that. And, you know, that's true. 93% of black people who are murdered by black people, but 84% of white people who are murdered by white people. We don't have a white on white crime. We don't have white on white crime rhetoric. We don't have white on white crime demonization. We don't have white on white paradigm because that doesn't serve a larger political purpose of undermining those particular communities and keeping them in check.
And you know, one of the things that I find fascinating that people are not looking at is the fact that when you have minorities going into the police force, and especially minority women, you find that they become subject to those same forces mm-hmm. that stress and de-stress a person out of shape. So you take someone who is good and maybe has a good heart, they go into the system. And they come out of the system twisted. And not everybody comes out twisted. Some people are managed to keep some parts of themselves whole. Mm-hmm. But, you know, remember, I was speaking with you earlier about my college boyfriend who went through the academy. He decided he'd rather be a police officer than a doctor and switched. Mm. And he wanted to help, and he really loved community.
Right.
And he said that, however, growing up and living in St. Louis and St. Louis County and working as an officer was traumatic because you are expected to do things as part of that policing force twisted and hurt him and a lot of his colleagues. And the fear was that if we spoke out, we'll get hurt. But that's where I get back to this moral high ground and the way you have written this book as a sermon is to try, if I get you right, to touch whatever compassion and empathy and heart and soul and love we still have left as humanity.
Right. Well, there's no question that we got to find some common ground, but we got to get people to see things from our perspective as well, to feel the pain, to have an empathy. You know, if you will, account, not a deficit, but a surplus where people can understand what these folk that they do not know, black and brown people, are up against. And so when we hear arguments like Rudy Giuliani makes, well, you know, it's only a few, you know, black lives that are being lost to white cops who are engaging in nefarious activity.
And that was applied to Castillo, Ohio.
Well,
yeah, I know.
Right, exactly. And or Sterling, for that matter.
Yes.
And, you know, the reality is that, okay, if we're going to play by those rules, then how many people have been killed by acts of terror since 9/11?
Yes.
I mean, maybe, is it 100? So why are you so obsessed with terror? It's not Muhammad, it's Billy Bob that's a problem. So let's address that. So those are the kind of contradictions we have to confront, and that's the kind of blindness, the willful innocence that whiteness leads to, that is conducive to, that we have to engage.
If, in a few words, you could sum up why you want white America to read this book,
mm-hmm.
What would you say?
Because times are serious, matters are urgent. We are living in very complicated and harsh racial times. We have seen the rise of a white demagogue to the presidency of the United States of America, the first toddler presidency, where the boo-hooing and terrible twos are being witnessed, the belly aching, the kvetching, the crying, the insolence, the immaturity, all of that. And the poop in that diaper was delivered by a society that shaped him. And so, you know, like all toddlers, they got parents and somebody produced them. And so Donald Trump is the product of so much of what has already gone on in this society. And this book targets what those factors and forces were, because I wrote my book essentially before Donald Trump succeeded Barack Obama as
actually,
president.
Actually, it came out
United
before
States
the inauguration.
Absolutely, sure did. And so, you know, I wanted to address this situation. What are the forces of whiteness that conspired to produce a Donald Trump? How did it create the logical extension of ideas to him? And how is it that we don't understand that Frankenstein is the name of the doctor, not the monster? So
that's
we
right.
have to understand what we have done, white
how
America,
we have
what
produced
you have done,
that.
Have produced
yes.
him. Absolutely.
The one thing that I do want to also ask is to kind of pull out in a nutshell, what can people do? Say they don't get a chance to read this book,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I want to say you've got some great and interesting accolades here. One of them being from Stephen King, who says, here's a sermon that's as fierce as it is lucid. And he said that all he could say after reading it was this is an amen.
Mm-hmm.
But say somebody does not get the opportunity to read the book but they say, well, we care about racism and white privilege. What should we do? What does the everyday person need to do in terms of kind of disengaging and removing the cachet of white privilege?
Mm-hmm. Well, they got to read the book.
So, in other words, there is no other way.
Well,
there are libraries. There's libraries.
Well, but, you know, mm-hmm. I make some recommendations here. You know, things that individual white brothers and sisters can do. Educate themselves about, you know, white privilege, white innocence, white fragility, and white vulnerability, and then get at those issues. Participate with black people and brown people in our struggles for justice. And call out to white people within your own society who you know are mucking up and messing up and really get with them to tell them that they ought to know better. Those are three of the things that can be done to challenge this unconscious white privilege and this implicit racial bias.
And so if I were to add, also believe what you hear and stop forcing people of color, and especially black people, to prove.
Well, this is why Obama happened. Kept repeating, we ain't making it up. I mean, you know, that was his point. We're not just generating this out of whole cloth. This is real. It has empirical roots. Y'all need to pay attention.
You know, I'm gonna ask this one question. I know mm-hmm. we're getting close on time. Mm-hmm. There are those that said Obama did or didn't do enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I maintain that it didn't really matter because he, being a black man, could not have gotten very much done with a white antithetical Congress, and it didn't matter if they were Democrat or Republican. Right. Some of them just didn't like them.
Right.
Do you think that, given the fact that whenever he did make mention of how race was significant and how racism was still real and potent, there was such a backlash, would it have mattered if he had tried to do more, or would it have been worse for us?
Well, you know, there are a couple things, and we can be of a divided mind on this issue. On the one hand, we acknowledge, as you've already indicated, that the resistance to him, the intransigence, was fairly astonishing, and it was fairly consistent, and it was planned, and it was political, and it was strategic.
Yes.
If he said up, they said down. If he said left, they said right. If he says wet, they said dry. If he says red, they say blue. I mean, it's just whatever it is.
If he said truth, they said lie.
That's right. They just want to contradict him. And he did an enormous amount of work, bailed out the automobile industry, gave us universal health care, though the Trump administration is trying to dismantle that, put the economy back on an even keel. There were many extraordinary things he did. But if you look at what he did specifically for the issue of race, and even more particularly for black people, then we'd have to say there's some limits.
Yes.
And even grading them on a curve, which is what black people did, because they were just grateful he wasn't killed.
Yes.
Anything else was gravy. If he lived, then that was a beautiful thing. But one of the things about the president is that he went out of his way to jump on black people. I am not the president of black America. No crap. We thought you were the head of the NAACP. We know you're not the head of black America.
That's right, yes.
And so he reminded us of lessons we didn't have to learn in order to present to us options that were false and that were based upon, I think, a false equivalence. For instance, when in his farewell speech, he said, look, black people and brown people and those who are anti-racist activists and so on, you know, also remember the white guy over here who looks like he's got privileges from the outside, but really may not. That would be akin to talking to women. Look, I know you're victims of racism and I mean, victims of sexism
and sexual assault,
misogyny and sexual assault. But hey. Look out for that patriarch over there who's got, trouble trying to feed his family. I mean, what? I mean, what? So that's the kind of false equivalency that was problematic with Obama. Mm-hmm. And yet there's an entire generation of young people who the only president they know is a black man from Hawaii.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, it's not fair for anyone to expect perfection from a human being. And we do have to, on occasion, be reminded that we can be the best we can be. And so I do want to say that with regard to humanity regaining that soul, or, you know, jump-starting it if it stopped, reading this book is one way to regain your soul and get yourself back in touch. Empathy, compassion, love, justice, all of that. Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America, will put you back in touch with that stream of consciousness. And so the book by Michael Eric Dyson is for you to read, as he said.
All right, boo.
All right, boo. I don't know whether to clap or snap. Thank you, Michael.
All right, love. Thank you so much.
So did you clap or snap?
I did them both. Okay. I did them both. You know, first and foremost, you are listening to your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and the Willamette Valley. It's 104.3 everywhere else, KBOO.FM. A shout out and thanks to Michael Eric Dyson. And, I want to explain one thing about this interview that makes it a little bit different and less impartial and more of a amen to whatever you say almost, Michael. And it's because when we're talking about the threats and the devaluing of black lives, one of the things that I was telling Cecil is, you know, I'm not talking about my grandson's lives, though I'm very concerned about them. You know, I'm not talking about my sons, my daughters, anybody like that. I'm talking about me. And when it has such a sharp crystalline focus about how I am concerned about my own life. It ceases to be a conversation or a dialogue that allows an impartial stance. You know, you take it personally, and you want people to hear that your life matters too, doesn't it?
So it's more than academic, it's very existential.
It's visceral.
Michael Eric Dyson's new volume is called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. We had a caller. Chris.
Okay. Corey, if you're there, come back.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. I'm really sad that I didn't get the opportunity to actually interact with Mr. Dyson. I also missed his event at Towers last week, but I'm really glad that I got to hear something of what he had to say. I haven't had a chance to pick up the book. I just wanted to, there were a few things when you got to Obama at the very end of the interview, and I just really wanted to speak back to those things, and I was really hoping that you guys would talk a little bit about his relationship with Obama vis-a-vis Cornel West, because there was some tension and some conflict, and I think there was some really good constructive criticism and that went on, you know, between our two most well-known black intellectuals in the United States, you know, especially as regards the historic presidency. I was really hoping to hear about that. But I have some questions, like, you know, I appreciated his comment about the false equivalency of the plight of black and brown folks versus white folks. But when he talked about universal health care, you know, I want to say critically that that was a handout for the insurance industry, and it was a half measure when he had a supermajority in Congress and the Senate. I also want to say that when he made a comment about the economy being on an even keel, that is a capitalist economy that systematically exploits black and brown people, that he maintained that system and did not fundamentally alter it. Not a single black banker went to prison. The first black attorney general now works for the very firm that represents those bankers. And so, you know, he objectively, Obama did not do enough there. And then the last thing he mentioned, that he revived the auto industry. That is, he used our taxpayer dollars to make it so that the private sector could have it back, and all the profits continued to go to the CEOs, while the people, like in his hometown of Detroit, where I'm also from, are still impoverished, are still drinking poison water, are still under unconstitutional emergency management systems. And so I really feel like Michael Eric Dyson needs to be held accountable and really speak to those particular issues. And I really wish that I had heard that, and I was sad that I didn't.
Chris, slow down, Chris.
Chris,
you got to stop. You gave us more than a mouthful. And I'm going to kind of cut you off at the knees by saying, I agree with you.
And but the thing is
did you hear what I said? Okay, there's a certain amount of holding him accountable, but that's not what this interview was about.
I hear you.
I only had a half hour, and I managed to keep sneaking the extra question on by saying, got this one question. So, you know, we tried to focus on that particular issue of the devaluing of black lives and how to get our white allies and our white, you know, co-citizens or whatever we want to call each other, you know, to recognize that. And the points you made, I totally agree. Not enough was done, and not enough criticism was leveled.
But wait,
Cecil got something to say, Chris. Hold on.
I apologize.
Okay, Chris. Certainly, I think it's you know, the point you made, I agree with Celeste. I have little to disagree with you. One thing that I would hope in another conversation with Michael Eric Dyson might expand on the first point you made in terms of, one, in terms of the differences, rift between Cornel West and Michael Eric Dyson, where early on after the first Obama campaign, Cornel West parted ways with and Michael Eric Dyson, in many ways, was an apologist for the president administration. Yeah. It seems at the end of that interview, I would be curious to ask. He offered more a critique of Obama than I've heard him publicly made during his administration. And so those are things to be explored at another time. So great. Thank you.
Yes. And that's why I asked that question, you know, is to find out exactly where he was and to see if he did have some a change of heart and was willing to articulate that.
Right.
But I appreciate your energy and your sense of urgency, though.
Yes. And let me say, I really appreciate that we do need to speak to the issue, especially after, you know, the discourse that's happened around the Women's March. We really need to keep that dialogue open about how folks who experience more privilege than others can find empathy. We can build bridges with them and get more involved and link up and start showing up and start acting. So I did appreciate that, and I'm really glad that you guys have had this conversation this morning.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for your call.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. I am Cecil Prescott, and we just heard a conversation that my co-host had, Celeste had with Michael Eric Dyson about his book, recent volume, Tears, We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. He is one of those persons who writes a lot on various themes, very able to talk and make connections with culture, politics, religion. This seemed to be a more, in some sense, way, a very personal book, and also an acknowledgement of racism to and how we might white America might respond to it. It isn't so much a call to people who are black and brown people, but it is to white America. And I'm wondering how people might respond to it. You know, we often hear of white sensitivity and
he mentioned those dynamics, though we didn't really talk about it. And again, it's as much a function of the short amount of time as it is trying to focus on it being a call to consciousness. I have a problem dealing with, shortcomings, confession. I have a problem dealing with this dynamic called white fragility. Like, I don't accept it.
No.
I have no time for that because I see it as a recentering away from the actual issue, you know? And okay. So I haven't had a lot of patience. And I call that a shortcoming because when I've done workshops or conversations or been involved in, you know, any dialogue with that, I always try to come from a position where, you know, we're trying to be receptive and we're going to hold a person accountable for not being spiritually conscious.
I agree to the sense that being aware and aware of where people are, mm-hmm. but I think the point you made just then, which I just forgot, but what's the point, was that it's a recentering to white people. It's like, no, it's not. You are not the center,
right.
And that need to hear the voices and the certainly leadership of. People of color, and it's not about you or how you feel. In fact, as much as we can agree that systemically And I think he begins his book by acknowledging that racism is sociologically constructed.
Mm-hmm.
Given that, though, there is a way in which we need to talk about how people are impacted by racism. In a recent conversation that Dr. Dyson had, he talks about that and talks about, you know, when the revolution come, will you still be white? And he talks about how Bernie Sanders is sort of a left-wing version of the president, in that they speak to a certain angst in many people, but that race is something that they have not confronted in a way that's transformative to our nations. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And we're talking about Michael Eric Dyson and race and his book. Celeste had an opportunity to speak with Dr. Dyson last week about his book, Tears We Cannot Stop.
You know, I was listening to that, you know, when the revolution comes, will we still be white? And it reminds me of a comment in the comments section of an article about, is it Megyn Kelly? Is that the woman's name? The Kellyanne, Connie, all of them, you know, the names start running mm-hmm. together after a while. And who left Fox and went to NBC and displaced Al Roker and I can't remember the other woman's name, but the two blacks that were on the Today Show.
Okay.
And somebody was making a comment about her defense of white culture, you know, because she insisted Jesus and Santa Claus is white. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a point to this, and I'm gonna try and get to it real quickly. And that being in the comments, one guy said, well, now the original Saint Nicholas was Greek, wasn't he? Or Turkish. And aren't Turks and Greeks and Palestinians, aren't they white? And I was laughing to myself and I said, oh, that's an interesting recentering. Mm-hmm. Because when it comes to being white and getting the political and social cachet, I can remember a time when being Greek or Turkish or Palestinian, you weren't considered white. When did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that whole recentering thing that I'm looking at. And I think sometimes when we try to have conversations about race, what happens within white America is that their consciousness will shift. Now, not everybody's, but, you know, those who really cling to it and the cachet, it'll shift so that they're less white when it's convenient. We're all human beings. There is no race. Race is a social construct, a political construct. And then suddenly, when it's convenient, those people who they didn't call white become white.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's one of the reasons why it's hard to pin it down, because that shifting back and forth, disingenuousness, I don't know, that's allowed, it's not challenged. It's like, okay, whatever you're going to be that, but address the devaluing of all of the people who are not part of your team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the thing.
Thank you.
What we want to focus on.
Yeah. And again, our call numbers are 503-231-8187. And before we listen to Susan, this is the quote he had about, Dr. Dyson had about Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the left-wing version of Donald Trump, not in terms of ideology or politics. That's ridiculous. I would ride with Bernie all day long. But they are elderly white men mm-hmm. who evince no substantive ability to engage race at a profound level. Both of them rush away from the specificity and particularity of blackness, and in Bernie's case, would rather subsume race under class. That's a mistake. Let's speak with Susan. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is Susan. And just a couple comments. A great interview first. Really appreciate that you were able to do that and wonderful questions. So one of the things I've been thinking about in the term of white privilege, and I've gone back and read some of the original articles about the back of that. One of the thoughts I had was that...
Wait, Susan, is your telephone and radio close? Because we're getting a lot of distortion.
Oh, I don't have a radio on. But,
okay, that's much better.
Let me just step out. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, so one of the things I've been thinking about is the that terminology doesn't have inherent with it the construct that supports that. When you say white privilege, so one of the ways I've been thinking about it is as white oppression exemption. So in other words, as a white person, I am exempt from the oppression that occurs in racism in our society, and that as a terminology then points to the cause rather than just saying white privilege. Because I've seen people, like with the term gentrification or even the word privilege, I think people can sometimes misunderstand that, or it comes with an unconscious meaning that's attributed in a more positive way. So that's all I wanted to say. That's just
I like the way that you kind of unpack it and kind of use a different kind of connotation. Is that you're right? That does kind of help change it.
Yeah, and so to me, I look at it and I am exempt from white racial oppression that other humans and people in my world are not exempt from, and that's, you know, am I calling as a white born into that exempt status is to be able to recognize it, to, as I think Cecil and both of you have said, to be able to call it out with other people that are exempt as well so they understand that, and to look, it's kind of both internally, because although I consciously try to recognize internal racism that I have because I was born in a racist world, in a racist country, in a racist society.
Yes.
It has seeped into me. And even though I had very liberal parents, messaging, and even as a very young person, it is inside of my world. So I'm trying to recognize it internally.
Susan, we're going to have to. Susan, we're going to have to ask you, we're having so much distortion with what you're saying, so it's difficult to hear, but maybe you can try calling again a little bit. But we appreciate what you had to say. Thanks.
Yes, thank you very much.
And we'll go to our next caller, John.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for a great show and a good discussion. And I'm mostly white. You got some Native American in me, but hey, I look white. And that's part of the problem, I think, is we're letting them divide us all the time based on color, whatever they can divide us on, sex.
And who is they?
They, meaning the institutionalized patriarchal power structure that's been in control of this country, really, let's be honest, since its beginning.
And who's being divided?
We are, from each other.
Okay, now which we the people are you referring to? Which we the people?
We the people, all of us. It's a class system, and we've got to try to pull together.
Okay, now see, and that's and that's the challenge right there, because as a person of color, I totally disagree. And when it comes to me trying to explain to white America why my life matters, to have it be reduced to economics is an insult. We keep trying to tell you they're not killing us because we're poor.
I agree with you.
So that's what we have to
have that focus if we can come together, because
Okay, so are you telling me
competition for jobs?
No, this is okay. No, it's not.
No, okay. I think it is. There's
white person, I need you to listen to a person of color. See, that's one of the challenges we have when it comes to having a discussion about race in this country. I'm looking at people who are the same shade as I am getting killed. We talk amongst ourselves. We hear us being targeted because of our color. And when we try to tell our colleagues, hey, we're getting killed because of our color, they say, no, it's because of jobs. Do you have any?
No, I'm not saying that. It's
but you just did. No, white person, this is when I need you to listen.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm trying to tell you it's not, and you're trying to tell me it is.
Well, ma'am,
your view.
I think it's a combination.
Okay,
of
but you're not being targeted, are you?
I'm low income. I've been targeted.
Are you being targeted? Do you feel? Do you feel as a group of people that when you walk out on the street, and especially if you have an encounter with law enforcement, do you feel that your life is in jeopardy?
No.
Okay, that's the difference. That's what I'm trying to get across to you. And it's not just law enforcement.
You're making your point, but I think we have to look at it long term, don't we?
Okay, so you're trying to tell me what...
amongst ourselves.
It's not about fighting amongst ourselves. It's about somebody valuing what I'm trying to tell them and looking at it from my perspective. But you're not...
The system does it. But I think if we
okay,
can
I'm going
to
defer to Cecil.
Economic class.
Okay, well, thank you. I know you think that. And it's really hurtful.
Yeah,
it's hurtful for you to keep saying that when we're telling you it's not.
Right,
so you're
right.
not helping the situation.
The long-term goal, I think, is we have to.
And no, that's your long-term goal. That's your long-term goal. Your long-term goal is to work together and pull together as a class. And I'm frustrated. I'm tired because this is a visceral effect. You know,
sure. I think that was a very an example. The quote I just read about from Dyson about Bernie Sanders and how you know, you can be on them all along. So you know if. Be with them in terms of economic analysis, in terms of class analysis.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, you can't forget about race, and to reduce everything to class is saying that one's life experience, a community's experience, is not valued. It is not equal to. To an economic analysis. And until we, the people, are able to recognize that and hear those voices and allow those voices to set the agenda for us to step back and say, well, maybe we are not the ones who should be in control. I mean, one thing, I'll leave it at that. I don't want to start a sermon. Let's try to get another caller really quick. Jan.
Good morning, Jan. Hello.
I was listening to the radio. I hear the radio in the back.
Okay, Jan, if you can hear me, cut the radio.
Okay,
okay,
goodbye,
we'll go
Jan.
To our next caller. Hello.
Hello.
Okay.
Okay. Do we have another caller? Okay, we're free.
All right. Okay, now you can take a couple of minutes for your sermon.
No, sermon completed. I just think it's interesting. You know, he just touched a little bit, you know, that quote in terms of, I mean, it's a historic one in terms of race and class. I mean, we can look back to the role of the Communist Party organizing in the 20s and 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And that challenge, especially in organizing in black communities,
mm-hmm.
about the role of class and race.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at books by authors like Richard Wright, Native Son, what's the other one I'm thinking of?
Those are not Black Boy.
Not Black Boy.
I know what you're talking about. I can't
but
think of it right now.
I think it'd be a good introduction for those of us who consider ourselves leftists or Marxists to look at the history of Marxist organizing in communities of color and the clash that happens when you try to impose an economic ideology as the centerpiece. And I think that what we need to remind us, listen, see the tears in our eyes.
Yes, and to recognize another human being in distress and not try to enforce what you think is the solution to the problem, but to be open to what that human being tells you is needed.
You've been listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station. Stay tuned for the OMO Variety Hour. I'm Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and we will hear you next week.
Good morning. It's 8:58, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, the OMO Variety Hour in just about a minute. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet. And at 11, On the Ground Radio presents Voices from the Mass Protest in Washington, D.C. of the inauguration. Plus, author and activist Professor Gerald Horn breaks down Trump's first week in office. And all of this great programming because of members like you. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. It's 8:59, the Old Mole Variety Hour, next.
Hey, it's Shenna from Pacific Underground, the radio show where Asians and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands. Join us this Friday at 9 a.m. for a special live episode where the entire Pacific Underground crew will join me for a lively roundtable discussion about new political policies affecting Asians and Pacific Islanders. We'll also have live interviews and we'll be taking your calls to talk about what's important to you and your API community. So tune in for a special Pacific Underground this Friday, February 3rd at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO, your community radio station.
KBOO with the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, The Yes Man Fix the World, will play Friday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. The Yes Man Fix the World is the true story of two guys in thrift store suits who impersonate corporate bigwigs and follow the twisted logic of corporate capitalism to its conclusion, exposing the absurdities and ironies of an economic system that ruthlessly rules the planet. Again, that's The Yes Man Fix the World, Friday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. Tell